Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 8, delivered on February 9, 2012. The title of this lecture is Financial Statements.
Today, financial statements. Now, you've all had accounting, or most of you have, and you're still with us, so I guess it wasn't that bad. But when I say financial statements, I'm sure you were exposed to the financial statements of a company, specifically a public company. Now, among those financial statements are the income statement. Can you tell me something? Another financial statement? That's cool. That actually means that you were successful in purging yourself of the experience. You don't have to have therapy. Madam, can you tell me another financial statement besides the income statement? How about the balance sheet? Yeah, that's one of them, uh-huh. Actually, I'm going to do something here. After I've given you the traditional list, I'm going to try to thwart that and give you a little bit more insight into financial statements from a more general point of view. But as far as financial statements go, there is the income statement. And tell me if this is reminding you of anything. Did that suck or what? Oh, you know what? Okay. Financial statements. Here we go. Financial statements. I'm going to take you inside of these here in a little bit. And for the weekend, I'm going to have put up on Blackboard just a little workout assignment you are to do in groups. Don't play lone wolf with me. It just rotates my ass. When I get single names, then that means that's more I have to grade. Do them in groups of 2 to 4 people, financial statements, and you'll do a little bit of work in this. It's nothing really complicated at all. But financial statements. There's the income statement. And then there's the balance sheet. Am I jogging memories here at all? What's another one that is in the financial statements? Yeah. Statement of cash flows. Statement of cash flows. Sometimes called the sources and uses statement or something like that. Statement of cash flows. Now, these are traditionally what you would be told are the financial statements, the big major financial statements of a company. The income statement, the balance sheet, and the statement of cash flows. Now, there are a couple of other minor ones, like the statement of retained earnings, which actually is a part of the balance sheet. Technically, the income statement is part of the balance sheet, too, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But of the big three, income statement, balance sheet, statement of cash flows, that's what you see in the book, as a matter of fact, textbook. There's another financial statement that is hugely important that's oftentimes overlooked, except by financial analysts. And it's one that, unless you do this kind of work, you kind of, I don't want to see that thing. Does anyone see one up there that I haven't put that you remember that you were taught about? You might not have even been exposed to it in your first, in a financial accounting course, the principles course, I don't know. It's the notes to the financial statement. The notes. These are wonderful. They're sort of not paid attention to, but in the notes to the financial statement, all kinds of disclosures are made about what happened in the financial statements, why things were done the way they were. nuances of explanation about, you might have something, oh, well, this capital stock increased and there was this issue of stock to the owners, to the president of the corporation, bonuses and all that. They might also say, well, here's how we did this tax thing here, and we explain that. And here is a future liability. You really can't put it in the financial statements themselves, but we really should disclose to you that we're on the hook for like $10 trillion here. That, it wouldn't be like that, but these financial statements notes are like the background explanation of what you're seeing in the financial statement numbers. And they can tell you all kinds of very interesting things. Now, when I became acutely aware of the notes of the financial statements, it was not in my finance education, it wasn't in grad school or anything like that. I became aware of the use and importance of the financial statements when I was a consultant. One of the companies, what I did, I think I've said this before, I helped small companies go public, or if they had gone public, get them into compliance or keep them in compliance. And I helped companies get listed on the cheapo stock exchanges, because that was basically the only way that their stock price could go up, is if I set up for trading in the stock so that people could buy and sell and all that kind of stuff. And I had to deal with the NASD, the National Association of Securities Dealers. It's a self-policing organization that oversees things like, okay, you want to be listed. You want a trading symbol for this stock of yours. Well, you're going to have to jump through SEC hoops, of course, to go public and to stay public, but you're also going to have to jump through ours. In that time, there was this, I didn't know jack about what I was doing. I know how to go public. I've gotten that part done. I know this company is public. How they got public, God knows. But, they want to be listed on the OTC, the over-the-counter market. They want to get a stock symbol, and they want to be able to, for market makers, for brokers and broker-dealers and all that, to be able to see the stock. Okay, all that will go through the NASD, and they have their own set of compliance documents, the most important of which is called the 15C211. You don't need to know that, but the 15C211 is essentially like a big explanation, information filing with the NASD saying, all right, here's what we are, here's who we are, here's what we do, here's our financial statements, blah, blah, blah. And you submit it to the NASD and they review it through their compliance office, and then they will eventually, if you do everything right, you'll get a stock symbol, a ticker symbol, and all that kind of great stuff. What I didn't know was that I was about to walk into the den of a wildcat. This, at the time, there was this officer who was a compliance officer. She was sort of like the evil queen. Her name was Claire. She was an older woman. I could tell by her voice, which kind of had an echo that I could tell she was speaking from hell. I mean, she abused me. I mean, it was like I should have brought powder for the spanking, but I filed this 15C2. Now, back in this time, understand that you could do it as a non-lawyer. Now, I would be some hard-timer's old lady if I tried to do this. They'd put me in prison right away. That's one of the reasons I got out of the business of doing these compliance documents. Or at least later, what I did was I'd do them, and then I'd pay some lawyer who was down and out to sign off that he'd done them. But at the time, I just did everything straight up, and I sent them in, and then I, like some idiot, I called compliance. Hi, did you get my 15C211? I was put with Claire, and Claire hurt my feelings from the beginning of our conversation. She just tore me up one side and down the other. This isn't right. Don't you know how to do this kind of stuff? This stuff had actually gone through SEC, and it was not good enough for Claire. It was truly a self-policing organization, and she took her job dead seriously. We got to the financial statements. They were audited and all that. And she said, here's the deal. And this is just one detail in the large thing. And she said, your financial statements. And I very quickly said, yeah, they've been audited. They're okay, right? And she said, no. She explained to me something that was a nuance, and she attacked the notes. That was where she focused. She said, these notes are how you are going to talk to the investors. And the sophisticated investors will be able to read these notes and read things that other people won't be able to see in them. What she explained in this one part, she said, okay, there's a going concern note. This company's financial statements were prepared with the assumption that this is a going concern. In other words, that there's going to be this hustle and flow of liabilities. You'll be able to meet the liabilities as they come due, and that you're never going to have cash flow that covers all your payments at one time. But of course, over time, you are able to make your payments as they come due with the revenues that come due. That's the going concern statement. It's in a nutshell. She said, you can't say that here. That's going concern boilerplate you put at the bottom of the end, the last note, which is always there. You don't do that. You have to say that these financial statements were prepared with the assumption that the company is a going concern. That assumption may not be appropriate for this company. She explained to me that hardly anyone would read that, but a sophisticated investor would get to the bottom and say, see, oh, this is the final statement that this is an extraordinarily risky company. And all those financial statements you see, even though they're audited, they have this assumption that might not be right for this little piss-ass company that you are trying to get to go public. She said, rewrite the note, which meant I had to get re-audit and all that kind of stuff. And then I did it, and I sent it back, and after a few more rounds, we got a list, we got a ticker symbol. But that was where I found out that these notes are actually like, I don't want to say a weapon, I'm trying to think of the right word, that they are an information resource, that you can make all kinds of disclosures so that later, the shareholders who ask questions, well, how did you do this? It's in note 7. Well, what kind of stock are you giving out to the president and to people like that? Well, that's in note 12. Did you get any stock yourself for being a consultant? That's note 24. You get in this finance notes these explanations so that you have the backup thing. We disclose this to you. These are things that we couldn't say in just the numbers, which are these three things. They're just numbers. But in the notes, I can explain this is how we did it, this is why we did it, this is what it means. Okay? Now, somewhere along the way, were you taught about the Edgar system? Okay, Edgar is a filing system of the Securities and Exchange Commission so that public companies can make their typical filings. And among those filings are filings that contain quarterly and annual financial statements. But more broadly, these financial statements you see here, if you want the financial statements, the way the SEC sees them, you go to the Edgar system. Edgar is the filing system of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Now, to give you a little background, one of the ways I made money early on as a consultant, Edgar has been an electronic system since at least the 1980s. I think it was in the 1980s, where you actually use something like HTML. It's called SGML. And you put these tags around all these things saying, this is the header of the title page. This is the subheader. This is the date. These tags, SGML, Standard Generalized Markup Language. And you just write this whole filing in this electronic form, and then you send it to Edgar. And I was an Edgar filing agent for quite a few years until it got taken over by some big dogs who could do it faster than I could. But anyway, in the Edgar system, you will type in a company. You can type it in several different ways. You can search by company name. If you have the ticker symbol, you can do it that way. There's another symbol that you can use, CIK, to search for a company. But once you get locked in on Edgar for a public company, you'll get a whole list of filings that company makes electronically. And they're in perfect order. You can go through them by section, by title of the document, by subtitle of what's in the document. And I'm going to give you a couple of them that you should be interested in. Even as an investor, or if you are just researching a company so that you can go to that company in an interview with a lot of knowledge about that company, go to EDGAR and look at its required filings. When a company goes public, it makes a filing, usually something like an S1 or an SB1, something like that. That's its public offering, and I'll talk about that in a subsequent lecture. But once it's public, it must make these routine filings. Among them are quarterlies called the 10-Qs. They have the quarterly unaudited financial statements of the company in them, along with a lot of other information. After a fiscal year is completed, the company will file a 10-K. That is essentially the culmination of the Qs that have built for the year. It gives the annual information, audited financial statements. You go to this 10-K, to get the real numbers. Don't go to MSN, Yahoo, or something like that, because at best, all they're doing is repeating and picking up RSS feed or something like that off the EDGAR documents. Go to the horse's mouth. It's right there for the public to see everything about that company. The 10-K gives you a lot more than just financial statements, but the financial statements are right there in a very clean, easy to read format, and it's meant to be a pursuant to transparency of public company operations. I would also encourage you, as far as financial statements go, you look at the income statement, the balance sheet, statement of cash flows, and the notes. There's another section which can be a killer long section, but it is darn important that you read through it if you really are interested in what's going on about a company. Within the 10-K are the financial statements and all that kind of stuff, but there's also MD&A, the Management Discussion and Analysis. You would be surprised at how glib companies get in the MD&A. It can go on literally for... Okay, back in my time, we were proud when we did a 35-page MD&A. I've been running into these EDGAR filings where you got 100 pages of MD&A. It can kill you, but it reveals so much. It talks in detail, even more than the notes do, about what's going on in these financial statements. It talks about, it's an analysis of the past and the future possibility, past operations and future possibilities of the company. It picks apart the financial statements and talks about projections. It's a very cool section, and it's only if you are sophisticated that you would think to look at this MD&A. And like I said, even if you're just going for an interview with a public company, read through the MD&A of that company. If you want to blow them away, you're going to know what's in that MD&A, because sometimes you'll even run into an interviewer who won't know, we said that in our MD&A? Yeah, you said that. They are quite glib, these documents. And I'll take a quick side note here on this particular point. This happened in the 1990s when I was in consulting. Since time began, filings with the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, were legal documents with a lot of very formal legalistic language, stiff, stilted words and phrases and terms, and all of that. There had been a push that had come out of several other industries to make contracts readable to the average person. The whole movement was called the plain language movement in documents. To make contracts for loans, to make contracts in insurance readable and understandable for an average person. This came into the Securities and Exchange Commission's gun sights in the 90s. They said, our documents are all according to these boilerplates of legalese and all this. We want you to stop doing that. We want you to start writing things in plain language. They opened up a discussion period, lawyers, financial analysts, consultants like me, to comment on plain language. I came down on the side of rejecting the plain language. I said, I don't want plain language. and I was way outnumbered. My logic was this. I don't want Joe and Ma Kettle to be able to read financial statements and 10-Ks and 10-Qs. I don't want them to be able to penetrate these documents. Because I can guarantee you that they'll think that they know something. If they can read it in language they understand, they'll think they know something. And they are still not ready to be investors. It will give a false impression, an approachability to things that they should not be approaching. I was, like I said, overwhelmed. So plain language is the rule in now. Everything is in plain language. These are very readable. Be cautious, though, because with plain language comes a looseness. You've got to be careful about reading because there's still a hell of a lot of technical detail going on. Anyway, Qs and Ks, quarterlies, annuals being filed. I'll bring up a couple of others that are off that you'll find in this long list of SEC documents that you might find are interesting to look at. You will see the, I got to warn you about something. I almost forgot. You find the 10-K for the latest year. Be careful. Go down and look around to make sure there's not a 10-K-A underneath it. In other words, an amendment to the original filing. Hell, my middle name was amendment because I'd file these things and then the company would say, oh, we forgot that. Oh, God, we have to do an amendment. Then I'd realize, okay, that's another $100 for changing a couple of words and refiling. But, so watch it. When you grab the 10-K, just look down very quickly to see if they did some kind of an amendment. And that would be especially important if it was in the income, one of the financial statements. They had to redo something based upon an error or based upon an interpretation. The SEC might come back and say, hey, look, you know, that wasn't so cool what you did there. Another one that you can find in the Edgar filings is the AR. The annual report should be there. These are periodic filings. It's just you do it every time you're supposed to. There's one that's interesting that's not periodic. It's the 8K. The 8K is a disclosure about a non-recurring event. You file these routinely whenever something unusual happens. Now, most of the time when I filed 8Ks, it was because the company had put out some hyping press release to try to pump the stock up so the insiders could dump or something like that. But it can be something like, well, the executive vice president of operations was killed in a car accident last week. Or it could be, oh, we just did a press release last week. This is the text of the press release. Or, oh, we just did something that was kind of major with the corporation. We signed a contract that was not expected, or we lost a contract that we didn't expect to lose. These 8Ks are actually kind of useful. Now, usually you'll see these in the news before the 8K filing, but sometimes it will be off the radar of the financial and business media. News media. So always look for these 8Ks. Just have a quick look inside. What is it that happened here? Oh, someone died. Who is that? Was it someone important? No, forget it. Or, oh, one of the directors of the company who'd been there for 20 years, he passed on. Well, that might be a little more important based upon whether he was a significant figure in the company's life. Over those 20 years he was a director. Just have a look. Just keep an eye on the 8K. Sometimes, like I said, they don't get on the radar of the business and news and financial news media. So you might want to have a look at them just to see if there's anything interesting in there. This is Edgar. Again, if you're looking for financial statements, go to Edgar. Go to the horse's mouth. Because even if you're going to someplace like MSN or Yahoo or something like that, they're probably pulling them off Edgar anyway, so you might as well go to the horse's mouth because at the horse's mouth, you can get all that other cool stuff that's there too, like the MD&A you can read and other stuff that's in there as well. Also, you can see pro forma projections and all that kind of stuff in the Edgar statements and all that. Enough of that. Now, financial statements. Financial statements. What is, well, I don't know if it's even relevant, meaningful to ask you this, but now that I have refreshed your memory about the financial statements, which one is the most important of the financial statements? Or like the center of the financial statements? Would you know that? Did they tell you that? Or did they give you some sense of which one was the most important? What would you say? Yeah, it is the balance sheet. That's like the fulcrum of the financial statements. Technically, everything else is a piece of the balance sheet. Let me explain this to you. And here I'm going to take this down and switch you over. Oh, well, that sucked. You know what? It was there just a second ago. As soon as I pushed that button, it flipped. Okay. And now we switch from the Macintosh operating system to the Windows operating system. And now it's going to grind along until Jesus comes back. It just frosts the fringes on my boxers. Not that I have fringe, mind you, but too much sharing, teacher. Oh, I really wish I hadn't done that. Okay. While that is figuring out whether it actually exists or not, let me just do something here. Okay. And this is wretched. And I should be shot for being so summary, but look, an income statement. At its heart, and I'm going to familiarize you, possibly refamiliarize you with just some terminology we use in finance for things. You've got revenue. That's how much money comes in. That's how much money you get from selling your stuff. Now, there will be nuances of that. They might say net revenue. In other words, people send stuff back. We don't want this. And you have to do those calculations. But at the end of the day, there's something revenue. That's how much money you've brought into the cash drawer. Now, if it's a manufacturing operation, you'll have another line here. Cost of goods sold. COGS. Now, cost of goods sold is expense that is directly related to the generation of revenue. So, for example, in my own business as a professional photographer, I can sell a print for $90. It costs me $12. God, that's obscene. $12 to make that. That's a cost of it. That's straight cost of it. So I can directly relate that thing I sold for $90 to that $12 it cost to make it. Now, there will obviously be other costs, but those costs that are related, intimately related, which is oftentimes the case in manufacturing, go in cost of goods sold. And once you have taken those out, you get your gross profit. And you'll hear me call it gross. Just that's what I'll say, gross. No, that doesn't mean that I just saw something that was disgusting when I say gross. That's just after cost of goods sold. Now, in service-related businesses, really there's no cost of goods sold. And you'll see in a lot of companies, there are financial statements. What the hell is on this screen? I wish I hadn't clicked that button. It's trying to sell me movies. No, I don't want to buy Twilight, for God's sake. Okay. Oh, great. The desktop now has ads on it. Okay. Hang on here. I'm going to try to get back to where the heck I was. This is a real pain in the neck. Okay. Bear with me here one moment. Okay. Maybe I can find it this way. I was pulling up the financial statements of Apple. I usually just pull Apple out just because they suck so much. No. Okay. Now, at the gross, after gross, well, actually, why don't I just put Apple up here? I've got it up now, so I'll just pull it up here. Excuse me just a second. Oh, that was Denny's from last night. No, I'm serious, noobs. No, I take that back. That was what came after Denny's. I shouldn't have eaten it. Okay, here. Shut up. Okay. Now, notice something about fiscal years. They're not always calendar years. It's just, you know, companies are all over the place. Their fiscal years are. I've always had this fetish with having my calendar and my fiscal year match each other with companies that I make. But a lot of companies, you'll see their fiscal year ends in some fashion otherwise. Like, for example, the end of the fiscal year for Apple is September 24th. It was for the last complete fiscal year. So you would expect that there probably is somewhere a 10Q with the quarterlies that came from September 24th to October, December 24th. There'd probably at least that Q is out there already, the Q1 for their fiscal 2012. But anyway, you got your revenues and your total revenues, which is rather interesting that they do that. But then you have that, there's that cost of goods sold line. That is expense that is directly related to those sales that you see in the revenue line. And as you can see, their COGS is pretty serious as a percentage of the revenues of the company. That's you notice that, and we'll talk about that when we do financial analysis next week. But right off the bat, you can say, geez, they pulled 37.5, and of that, a little more than 24 was just cost of the stuff that they were making that they could directly relate to the stuff itself. That's a pretty heavy amount. Surprising. It could be surprising. Last year, I took the Financial Management Association students up. We went to a couple of places in Chicago, places where they could learn business operations, get some names to contact for internships and jobs. At the end of that, the last place we went was to a place called Oberweis Dairy. Very cool operation, very significant operation. And the financial CFO was talking, and I said, all right, what is your percentage of what kind of a percentage of revenue is your cost of goods sold? He actually kind of shrugged his shoulder. He said, I don't know. What, you don't know? He said, no, I have some bean counter do that. But I said, do you have a sense of it? And he said, yeah. I said, what is it? And I named it, and I took a shot. I thought I was going to go on the high side. I said, what, 40-45%? And then he got serious. He said, yeah, right about in there. I thought I was on the high side at 40-45%, but that was right about where it was. So there you are right there. This is above that. This is more than 50%. I don't know. What is that? That looks more like about 60-65% along in that area. Notice that it has actually declined over the years. Okay, anyway, enough of that. There's your gross profit I'm pointing at, like you can see where I'm pointing. There's your gross profit right there. In other words, this is how much money is now available to pay the general expenses of the company. And you look at those and you say, all right, selling, general, and administrative expenses. Now, they didn't break it down here. You'd have to dig in further, but that's okay. This is things like salary, lights, telephones, utilities, all those different things like that. That's selling and general, selling, general and administrative expenses, salaries for the people, light bill, phone bill, travel, meals and entertainment, mailing, you name it. That's all in there in that selling and general, general administrative expenses. Now then you have this R&D expenses, which is a somewhat different animal because they can spend a huge amount on R&D, research and development, but they're not allowed to expense it. In other words, if you spend $100 million, if Apple spent $100 million on R&D, they're not allowed to say minus $100 million. They have to amortize it like depreciation. So in other words, you see that R&D expense there? That we're going to have to add back when we want to talk about real cash money moving in the company. Because most likely that R&D expense is a number that is an accounting number, and it really didn't happen. Money was really spent. We got to find out what it was so we can take it out, but we have to add that number back in. Just like depreciation. We have to find out how much they hacked off in depreciation, add that back in because it didn't really happen, and then take out the real number of how much cash money was spent in physical building, plant, and equipment and all that. Okay, now the other operating expenses. This is where you have to dig to a more detailed financial statement or look in the notes to the financial statement to find out what they mean by other. What does other mean? They were making payoffs to alien civilizations not to attack them. They were other expenses. Did that include maybe cryogenically freezing Steve Jobs' head so they could bring him back later when they could put a robot body on him, as if they hadn't already? Okay, you get down here to operating income. That's your... Okay, now the operating income is what we call EBIT. Earnings before interest and taxes, EBIT. It's an important, mighty important number. EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. Now on the next slide, they include investment income with the interest, which kind of muddies up the water a little bit, but there you are. That's how financial statements actually work. They never look perfect and pure. But at the next line, they're hacking out the interest. Here's why EBIT is important. Why we stop and put that line EBIT before we put the interest. Here's why. Suppose that your EBIT is $100 million and your interest that you have to pay for the year is $120 million. What does that mean? Okay, again, let me do it. $100 million is your EBIT. Then the next line is interest. Your interest expense is $120 million. What does that mean? That means you're bankrupt. You're gone. You're with Jesus. You know why? Because you had $100 million and you had to pay $120 million in interest. That means it's over for you. You can't pay your interest. That means that the debtors get to come in and do awful things to you because they now own your ass. They will shoot your dog. They will take your Bible and sell it on Craigslist, and they will make your mother wear furry costumes that please them. Mrs. Fox is a good starter kit. Never mind. You're too young. Later, I'll explain. You have to have enough money to pay your interest. Because if you don't, that's the end of the game. Game over. It's over. You're done right there. So that's why we stop at op income, at EBIT, to say, all right, this is how much money we have. Now we've got to deal with what the debtors are owed, the debtors who can come and take us into force us into Chapter 7 and then liquidate our assets. So that's why that operating income line is so important. That's why it's there. And so that we can stop and say, all right, we've paid our workers, we've paid our light bills, we've gotten all those debts out of the way. Now we get to the line where let's get real, let's see what we've got to be able to cover the interest expense. Because if we can't pay the coupons on our debt, on our bonds, if we can't pay the interest on our short-term debt, if we can't pay our loans from the banks and from the other people who lend us money, if we can't pay the interest on those, we're out of business. That's it. So that's why that EBIT line, operating income, is mighty important to us. And that's then we go pay our interest, and then our net interest expense there, And then we got some oddball stuff, currency exchange gains and non-operating. Boy, they got their asses beat on currency exchange. Wow. Anyway, enough of that. And then we get to EBT, earnings before taxes. That's the line where we stop again and say, all right, now we're going to have to see how much income we've got that we have to pay to Uncle Sam. Notice here that I have paid interest before I calculate what Uncle Sugar is owed. In other words, interest is tax deductible. That's one of the things that makes interest so a debt so attractive. You pay dividends after you've paid taxes. So dividends are darned expensive compared to borrowed money because I get to deduct that from what I have to pay. I get to deduct that before I calculate my bill to Uncle Sam. So here we go. We get down here to the EBT line, excluding unusual items. And again, you try to ignore those politely. And so we are now at income taxes. Okay, on Apple, Apple earned $34.2 billion. Billion. That was taxable. That was exposed to taxes. And then from there, and I'm going to talk about taxes here in a little bit, but now we can say, all right, what do they have to pay in tax on that? They paid a total of about $8.2 billion in taxes on $32 billion in pre-tax income. Now, if you wanted to calculate that, and actually, I already did this, and I can't remember what I came up with the number. If I were to do that, just real quick here, their average tax was 8283 for the last fiscal, 8283 divided by 34205. So they paid 24.2% of their pre-tax income in taxes. They paid about a quarter of their pre-tax income in taxes. That's actually not that unusual. They do save a lot of money by moving money, their profits offshore, their taxable income, making sure that it's offshore where it can't be taxed. It would be a lot higher for most of these massive corporations if they weren't doing that trick of keeping it away from U.S. tax authorities. And there was a push again this year to try to stop that. But then these companies came back and they came back with this idea that was brought around once before. Give us a tax holiday and we'll bring all that money we've got offshore back to the United States and we'll make jobs here with it. But until you do that, we're just going to keep all that money offshore. And so there's been a discussion, we did this once before, some years back, there's a discussion, should we give these companies a tax holiday so that they can bring all that money that's being protected from taxes back to the United States for investment and building stuff and making jobs? Or should we say, no, you bring it back, we want you to face taxes like normal Americans do? That's a whole big discussion in itself right now. Okay, now there's your earnings from continuing operations, 25,922, and fortunately that's net income, 25,922. So your net down there at the bottom is 25,922. Now that's where things get a little bit, now we can talk interesting. 25,922. That's 25 billion. I think that's billions. Let me go back up and make sure that I'm saying that right. Is that billions? Yeah, that's billions. That just blows me away every time I say billions like that. Okay, here's what that means. That in an accounting sense, that 25,922 is now what for the end of fiscal 2011. Is what the shareholders can claim. The shareholders have $25.922 billion. That's how much they have. They have satisfied in a timely manner the debts. Everything above that line was in one way or another a debt. So the world is cleanly divided between what is above the net income line, which is all the satisfaction of one kind of debt or another as it has been, as it has come to do. And then that net income line, 25,922, which is the residual claim of the owners, the equity. So again, above net income, that was all paying one kind of debt or another, whether it was a utility bill or an interest expense or a manufacturer of some intermediate part, it was all something you owed to external agents. At the net income line, that's the shareholder's claim. And it can come in, that claim can be satisfied in two ways. Based upon the judgment of the directors of the company as expressed through the executive management of the company, that claim can be satisfied in one of two ways. Net income. Either it will be paid as dividends, or it will be plowed back. As a contribution to retained earnings. Which is where we get the statement of retained earnings in the balance sheet. Because in the owner's equity section of the balance sheet, you will see this part where they have the retained earnings at the beginning of the period. You add in the net income, subtract out the dividends to get this contribution right here, which you add to this to get the retained earnings at the end of the period. In other words, the net income, once you have given that candy to the shareholders to make them happy at the shareholders' annual shareholders' meeting, that is added to the cumulative amount of retained earnings to get how much accumulated retained earnings exist at the end of the fiscal year. It doesn't exist as an actual account anywhere in the universe. It's just a tally, a running tally of how much buildup of net income minus dividends has been happening since the company came into existence. That part right there is added to the shareholders, the stock that they sold, the money from stock that they sold, to get your total shareholders' equity. We'll go to that in a minute. But again, but this comes back to the point that I was making before. You see this net income statement right here? See that net income statement? That is actually just a giant nodule, a long calculation that adds one little piece to the balance sheet. At that whole income statement, this whole thing comes down to the net income minus dividends makes for the new contribution to retained earnings. So again, in that sense, the income statement is just a little nodule that is expanded as a calculation for the balance sheet. That's why that balance sheet is actually the center of the entire financial statement structure of a company. Now let me come up here, and I'm going to give you your balance sheet and try to get this out of the way as quickly as possible, but I don't want to shortchange it. Okay. we go through this, and you'll see more about why we care about this from a financial analysis perspective later. But the first thing is we look at the cash and equivalents. Now, equivalents means things that could be turned into cash virtually immediately. Investments in treasury bills, investments in very liquid other instruments, that's cash on the balance sheet. We're in the assets section, and we're specifically in the short-term assets section. Now, short-term investments, they are actually part of the nearly as liquid. As you go down here, you're getting a little less liquidity. But short-term investments, they might throw money into commercial paper. They might throw a lot of money into quick, fast investments of one kind or another. So that would be there too. So notice that Apple keeps actually a considerable amount of money. That's a lot of money there. See that 9? That's a lot of money. You add to that another, what, about 16? They got a lot of liquidity. In other words, if you're looking at those two together, that's serious liquidity. Now, here's the thing about liquidity. It's great because you can grab money out of your pocket, but the downside of liquidity is that it's not earning big money for you because it's not going into long-term investments, which pay more than short-term investments, generally speaking. So this high degree of liquidity you see here is at the cost of using that money in a longer-term fashion. Accounts receivable, other receivables, and there's all your receivables. They work it down a little bit more complicatedly than others do. I don't know what restricted cash is there, but anyway. Now, within this, you'll have inventory. Okay, the big ones are your cash and its equivalents. You're going to have your receivables are important. And then, finally, you've got some other things in there. Inventory is awfully important. And some deferreds are important. But the big ones are cash and equivalents, receivables, inventory. You want to keep an eye because you'll need those for financial analysis purposes. You get down here, that's your total current assets. Now, you look at, now let me go down here to liabilities. Going down in the short-term liabilities, accounts payable, accrued expenses, current payable, currently stuff that's currently payable. And sometimes they'll have some very short-term borrowings that are in there too, but they don't. But you get to your total current liabilities, okay? Now, one of the things that we will care about is your current assets minus your current liabilities. Okay, current assets here are 44.3, is that? Is that what that is? And then your current liabilities are 27.9. The difference between those is what's called your net working capital. Write that down. Current liabilities minus current assets minus current liabilities is your net working capital. That's, in other words, your excess of short-term liquidity, short-term assets over obligations that would become that would come due in the short run. This is a lot like work. The current assets minus current liabilities is called net working capital. That is just simply a dollar measure of your liquidity, your excess of liquid assets over liabilities that could come due relatively quickly. So in other words, pick on you. How much do you owe this week to people and to businesses and to things like that? Nothing? You know what? Okay, how much money do you have? Never mind. You have some money?
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, so you have a positive net working capital. You have an excess. Now you probably, I don't know, you probably owe someone some money or you gotta pay a bill, I don't know. And you're going to have to eat some noms this week and all that. And so, but you also have money that you can pay these bills with. If you have more money to pay those bills with, then those bills will come to. You've got a positive net working capital for the week, okay? If you don't, then you're going to starve to death. Or, I don't know, you'll mooch food off people on the street, I don't know. But that's all it is. It's can we cover our short-term bills with our short-term liquid stuff that we've got. And it's really theoretical because you're never going to, well, you hope you're never in a position where you would need to worry about, can I pay my current bills with my current assets? But we keep an eye on it anyway. Now go back up here to the long-term assets. Long-term assets, there's your property, plant and equipment, okay, and that would, you minus out the accumulation of all that depreciation expense and all that kind of stuff, and you get your net property, plant, and equipment. And then goodwill, that's basically money you paid because you were stupid. Okay, I hate to say it that way, but goodwill is a place where, okay, that company was worth $100 million. Just to show how butch we are, we bought it for $150 million. So $50 million would be goodwill. That's an awfully simplistic way to explain it, but really, that's what you're doing, is you're putting there what you can't justify by the actual numbers that are associated with a purchase of something. Long-term investments and all that, other intangibles, that would be like intellectual property assets and all that. And then you got your total assets. Now let me get down here to the total your non-current liabilities. Revenue, deferred tax. What the hell? Okay, I am so sick at looking at these damn financial statements where I don't see a debt line. Anyway, in here, there should be a debt line. I don't know how where they're hiding it, but there's a line that represents their long-term bonds or long-term debt. Now, in the next lecture on financial analysis, when it says debt, when we do ratios that you need to know the debt, don't just look for the debt line in long-term liabilities. Go up to the current liabilities, or go up in the long-term liabilities and look for something called notes payable, because that is another form of debt. It's just it's all debt. But that's shorter-term debt that you should add to the long-term debt. So if you see a debt line, yeah, that's debt. But also make sure that you add in notes payable, which is just shorter-term debt that you'll need to. Then your common equity, total equity. Enough of all this. At the end of the day, the financial statements are a representation for consumers of information. But you also have to understand, that those financial statements for a financial analyst because they include stuff that we don't care about, that's not real money, and they have stuff in them that isn't real cash coming in. Okay, I have just sold you a whole pile of my stuff. $5,000 worth. Okay, so on my financial statements, I have to say revenue $5,000. But you paid $3,000 in cash and the rest is on credit. So from an accounting point of view, I got $5,000. I'm rich. Let the good times roll. We're eating at Denny's tonight. Bring your dogs. Okay, but realistically, from a financial analysis point of view, I have got to subtract, take that $5,000, and I've got to subtract out that increase in credit sales. See, my credit sales popped by the amount that I extended you in credit. So I saw that increase in credit sales. I have got to take that out. That is not part of my true cash flow. So I would have to take my net income, and I would have to subtract out, what did I say, $3,000 in credit sales. I have to take that out in order for me as a financial analyst to see clearly the picture of the actual amount of cash. Depreciation expense, there it is. Right there on those financial statements, it is there. I have to add it back in because it's not real. Amortization is the same way. I don't write checks to these, so I have to add those back in to see what's happening to real cash flow in the company. Okay, now, let me take you through just a few highlights on this for you highlight hounds out there. It would not be on the financial statement, but I have retired a bond. I was making my coupon payments. That was interest expense. But at the end, I actually paid off a $10 million issue of bonds that I had done 20 years ago. Now I've paid it off, $10 million. So in terms of my cash flow, I would take net income. Would I add $10 million or subtract $10 million from that, representing the payoff, the retirement of that bond issue? Would I add or subtract that $10 million? Yes, I would subtract it. You were guessing, weren't you? No, you would subtract it because I didn't recognize it in the income statement, but hell, I just put $10 million out of my pocket. Real money. I mean, that's real money. I wrote a check for $10 million. So whatever that net income line said, I have got to take away another $10 million. That is a use of cash. Okay? Let's try another one. Okay. Last year, my accounts payable were $8,000. This year, they've gone to $11,000. Now, nothing about that's really going to show up on the income statement. So net income isn't going to reflect that change. But my accounts payable, what I owe other people, went from $8,000 to $11,000. So would I, to look at cash flow, would I add $3,000 to net income or subtract $3,000 from net income? Think logically. I'm glad you asked. You volunteered. Okay, now. You had $20,000 in bill last year, okay? You still owed $8,000. Now this year you had $20,000 in bills, but you owe $11,000. So which year are you got more money in your pocket? Yes. So would I subtract or add? So accounts payable increasing means that I'm chintzing other people. I'm keeping money in my pocket. So I'm going to add $3,000. Accounts payable, that increased. That means that I get to keep more money. I do it all the time. Oh, hell, that bill can wait. I've been saying that for 10 years for some of my bills. But you see, as you don't pay bills, as your accounts payable increases, well, that means that you're just saving money. So I'm going to add $3,000. Let's talk about receivables. Over time, you've always, you know, paid most of your, made people pay cash. You extended credit to a few people, but usually you wanted everyone to pay cash. So your receivables were $2,000. But you realized that you were killing yourself on some of your, there's a reason why you let people buy on credit. That way you get a lot more people buy from you because you can convince them, you don't have to pay anything now. 6 months from now, deferred interest, buy now, pay later. You can get more sales that way. But what does that do to the amount of money that's going into your cash drawer? If my accounts receivable goes from $2,000 to $10,000, is that an increase or a decrease in real cash money? That's a decrease. Good. You simply write down $8,000 because your accounts receivable went up. That means that you're not getting as much money in your pocket, so you got to take that out of net income to do that. Let's try one more. I sold some stock. I sold a pile of stock to investors. Now, that's not going to show up on the income statement anywhere. I found some suckers. You were one of them. Matter of fact, you were the whole nine yards. I sold you $1 million in stock. It's nowhere on the financial statements at all. The income statement. So what do I do? How do I recognize that as far as adding or subtracting $1 million from net income? Should I add it or subtract it? You would add it back in, because that's $1 million I got from you, you sucker, that's now in my pocket. Not that it's not a good investment. It was a damn good investment. Things just went wrong. It was the economy. It was the president. It was the Congress. It really, don't blame me because you lost your shirt and now you're living on the street. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.